is just saying, you have an option. This is not the only way that you can think about things. Here, I'm exposing you to a different way of thinking, but nobody can control that. Only you can decide how you're going to think about this. And so we give them the opportunity of trying it out, of playing this game and playing full out and again, losing and winning and trying to reframe that loss as learning.
Hello, and welcome to the February 23rd, 2024 edition of the TriDoc Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Zankoff, the TriDoc, an emergency physician, triathlon coach, and multiple Ironman finisher, coming to you from beautiful, sunny Denver, Colorado. Another couple of weeks and another spot of news related to rebranding in the world of professional triathlon. This time, the news is coming from the organization formerly known as the Super League, which as of about a week ago, rebranded itself to be simply SuperTri. For those of you who might not be aware, the Super League has been around since 2017 and did a fine job of injecting some real excitement into multisport by being very creative around short course racing. They had team competitions on some very exotic and disparate courses, they introduced the wildly popular and highly entertaining arena games, and seemed to be on the cusp of really breaking out when they kind of fizzled a little bit over the last few months. The arena games, for example, didn't reappear this season, at least to this point, and the air was taken out of the bubble just a little bit when the whole fiasco surrounding the Malibu triathlon with the PTO took place over the last several weeks to months. Well, maybe we can hope that with this rebrand, the page will be turned and they will be able to grab back some of the excitement that the Super League had built previously. SuperTri, strangely, all spelled out in lowercase letters, will be comprised of the SuperTri E, that was previously called the Arena Games, and the plain old SuperTri representing the championship series of races. Now, a lot remains unknown. Like, for example, when and where can we expect to see any SuperTri E competitions? And what races will comprise the SuperTri Triathlon Majors? Those are going to be the major outdoor events. We know that the Chicago Triathlon and Legacy Long Beach Triathlon will be two of these, but the third race, the New York City Triathlon that was initially part of the Triathlon Majors for SuperTri, has unfortunately been officially canceled for 2024. And this is a major disappointment, not just for SuperTri, but for everyone, since the popularity and success of that event previously was so great, and it's obviously a blow to SuperTri right out of the gate. So, like the PTO with its T100 series that was released with a lot of fanfare and even more questions, we're kind of seeing the same thing with SuperTri. Though in this instance, I kind of tend to have more faith that things will be sorted out and the ship will sail as intended, but time will tell. Again, for the sake of our sport, I hope that this goes according to plan. The Super League really delivered some pretty good excitement and some very entertaining races. I'm hoping that SuperTri will be able to follow through and do so in short order. Another interesting tidbit comes from our friends over at Ironman, who announced a new 70.3 race in Penticton, British Columbia, to run alongside the incredibly popular full Ironman at the same location on the same day. Like Ironman Canada, the swim will take place in Lake Okanagan, and the bike, it's going to be no joke. A single lap affair that does not involve a climb over Richter Pass nor up to Yellow Lake, it still features some 3,000 plus feet of elevation gain over the 56 miles. The run will then be a single lap of the Ironman course, which also features a fair amount of climbing itself, especially in the first half. The excitement about this event was pretty high on social media, and I think for good reason. Penticton is a beautiful setting for a triathlon, the community is incredibly supportive of the sport, and Ironman Canada has been a fantastic event for a very long time. Now, if Mother Nature cooperates and the Okanagan region is spared of forest fires, this could prove to be a new bucket list 70.3, but it is definitely going to be a tough one. Speaking of tough 70.3 events, for those of you who are signed up for the 70.3 in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho this June, Ironman is going to be putting on a Lunch and Learn webinar on March the 13th at noon Pacific, hosted by none other than me, your friendly neighborhood TriDoc. I'll be talking about the course, race logistics, and more. So if you or anyone you know could benefit from that, I hope that you'll use the link in this episode's show notes to sign up for that webinar and be sure to tune in. On the show today, the medical mailbag is going to tackle a subject that is pretty relevant for many of you listeners and even for Coach Juliet Hochman herself, and that is, how do we manage returning to training after illness? You see, Juliet was down and out with a nasty respiratory bug for the past week or so, and knowing when it's safe to get back to training is important if she or you want to do so in a way that maximizes your ability to train and minimizes the likelihood of prolonging illness. We're going to talk about a variety of common illnesses and how to best manage convalescence and return to training for each, and that's coming up shortly. Later, I'm joined by Christina Ramirez. Christina is a three-time Ironman athlete who is a best-selling author of the book Empowered by Discomfort. She also teaches an Empower Fit curriculum to school children that helps teach growth mindset to kids by leveraging running games. She has also co-founded an organization called Thumbs Up International that pairs adaptive athletes with able-bodied athletes to allow for pairings to compete and complete endurance events. Christina's a real dynamo, and I know that you're going to enjoy hearing our conversation that's coming up in just a short bit. Before all of that, I want to take my customary moment to thank all of my Patreon supporters of this podcast who have decided that for about the price of a cup of coffee per month, they could sign up to support this program and in doing so, get access to bonus interviews and other segments that come out about every month or so. Those bonus episodes are available on a private feed for all of my subscribers. Plus, for North American supporters who sign up at a $10 per month level of support, they receive a special thank you gift in the form of a BOCO TriDoc podcast running hat. So visit my Patreon site today at patreon.com/TriDocPodcast. Learn how you can become a supporter and sign up so that you can get access and maybe this cool gift as well. And as always, a thank you in advance just for considering. Juliet Hochman has joined me once again. Juliet, how are you doing?
I'm great. That's an enthusiastic hello. Thank you.
I'm always enthusiastic to see you, and I'm enthusiastic, of course, because if Juliet's here, that means it's time for the medical mailbag, that segment of the program when we are here to answer the questions that you, my listeners, have, or, as might be the case in this particular segment, my co-host, Juliet, has, that we're going to try and parse out for you to understand the different things that come up. What are the things that we should be doing? What are the things we should be using in order to make our training, racing, and recovery better? So, Juliet, what's the question that you have for the medical mailbag?
Well, my timing on this is perfect because I know you just wrote an article in Triathlete Magazine about this. And I know that we both get questions, this question from athletes all the time. When is it safe and appropriate to return to training after being ill? And of course, being ill is defined by a number of different factors. And I know you're going to break that down a little bit. But particularly at this time of year, here we are, what is it, February 22nd? Feels like winter's never going to end. We're still in cold and flu season. I know you see this a lot in the ER. I had the flu last week and I was trying to be my own coach and know when to return to training. I'd give myself about a B. talk us through, you know, let's talk about the different maladies that one gets, particularly at this time of year, and when it's safe to return to training, when it's safe to train through it, what the effect on our overall training is in terms of losing fitness and that type of thing. Because, of course, that's always the big concern from athletes is, oh, my gosh, I'm going to lose, you know, days and days and days if I take a day or so off. So let's just tick through the list here.
Yeah, for us as endurance athletes, illness is more than just a pain in the butt of feeling under the weather. It's a huge disruption, right? I mean, here we are. We have our highly scripted routines. We have our schedule that we work so hard to put together that our coaches work with us to try and fit into our lives. And then all of a sudden we can feel it coming on. We get that scratchy throat. We start to feel under the weather and all of a sudden everything is laid waste and we hate it. I hate getting sick. I don't know anybody who enjoys it, but we all hate getting sick. I know that if my kid comes home from school with a cold, I'm like, oh my God, batten down the hatches, right? Break out the hand sanitizer, 100%. Do whatever we can to quarantine them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And nobody likes to get sick, but.
Yeah. And I also find, there's so many shades of gray, right? And there's sometimes when you're like, okay, there's no possible way I'm going to go train today. It's just not happening. It's so obvious. But then you get into this great big, huge gray zone of, well, I wonder if I could do zone two, or I wonder if I could just sit on the trainer, or I wonder if I could tolerate a run. I went back to the pool a little bit too early last week. And you know what? It's hard to breathe underwater anyway as mammals. And then you try to do it with a congested chest and it's like, oh my God, yeah. What a disaster. So.
Yeah, we're often our own worst enemies. So let's just talk a little bit about what illness is doing to our bodies when we get something. So most of the illnesses we're going to talk about are going to be viral, because let's face it, that's the big thing that we face. Illnesses come in various forms. Basically it's the invasion of our organism by something that shouldn't be there. It can either be a virus, a bacteria, or a fungus. If you've watched The Last of Us, that's an example of a fungus gone awry. One that fortunately we don't have to worry about, but there are funguses that can attack us and cause problems. But for the most part, the vast majority of infections that we face, especially at this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere, is viral. And those viral infections in general are benign, but they take a little bit of time to get over. And the reason they take a little bit of time is because these viruses have evolved to be quite successful at doing what they do, which is to take over our cellular processes so that our cells stop doing what they're supposed to be doing and instead focus all of their energies to creating more viruses. And then our immune system and a variety of other different processes within our body will all kind of muster their resources towards identifying this foreign invader and destroying it. And in so doing, it really, really sets off a whole bunch of processes that kind of commandeer our metabolisms and commandeer a lot of our resources. And because of that, as you just alluded to, it becomes difficult to exercise. Because think about it, you go out, even zone two, right? You need a lot of energy to do a exercise routine at zone two. And if you're suddenly taking a lot of your basic metabolism, suddenly taking a lot of the energy that you're using, you eat a general meal and don't forget, when you feel sick, your appetite's depressed, so you don't eat as much. And now you need calories to fight off this infection, and now you're going to go try and exercise as well. It just becomes difficult. So there is that balance that has to be recognized about whether or not we should be doing training. And what I always tell people is, look, I know how hard it is to not exercise on a given day, but you have to think to yourself, are you going to be able to exercise in a way that is going to be beneficial to your overall training? Or are you going to benefit more from taking the day off completely, giving yourself a chance to rest and get better quicker so that you can get back to your regular training faster? Now, that's a hard thing to kind of imagine because people don't like this idea of taking a day off. But if you're going to just get on the bike to spin just for the sake of saying, oh, I did it, but you really didn't get anything out of it, it didn't actually enhance your training, then did you really do anything? Now, I want to be clear. There is a lot of evidence that doing exercise when you're ill does not prolong illness. So you're not going to keep yourself, you're not going to make yourself sicker, you're not going to prolong the illness. But if you're not getting anything out of it, if you're not getting anything out of that training, then, and you feel like crap when you're doing it, take the day off. As hard as that is psychologically, take the time off, because you're going to feel better just lying in bed and just having that chicken soup and doing those things that make you feel better when you're ill.
Well, and I also think it's a matter of sort of diverting resources, right? The way I look at, particularly if I'm running a fever, which I did for a good solid 3 days last week, and we've talked about this image before, I sort of imagine this little army inside my body, right? And it's marching through my bloodstream trying to fight off this virus. And if all of a sudden I introduce increased heart rate or increased respiratory rate, to that equation, that, you know, that little army has to turn around on its left flank and go, wait, wait, there's something else going on over here. I can't focus on fighting the virus, right? So why not give that army an opportunity to fight the one thing that's in front of it rather than, you know, trying to deal with some almost meaningless, you know, zone two ride for an hour just to make yourself feel better.
I think that's a really great sort of analogy, metaphor, because that's exactly what's going on. If all of your resources are mustered to fight off this infection, and now you're going to divert some of those resources to exercise, you're kind of taking away from both, and you're going to feel crappy afterwards. I mean, think about how you feel after a zone two effort for an hour. You usually feel like, well, yeah, you did something, but you don't feel exhausted. But a zone two effort when you're sick, you feel absolutely exhausted and drained. And it's not because the effort was so much harder, but it's because you didn't have the resources at your disposal that you normally would, because those resources were taken up fighting that illness, exactly the way you just described. So I think it's a really, really good analogy. Now, the other thing I just, you know, you mentioned fever, and we're going to talk about some specific illnesses, but there is a pretty reliable guidance that's been provided through the years, and it's called the neck check. And it kind of applies to a host of different illnesses. And it talks about whether or not it's safe to train through illness. And physicians have said for a long time, if you have symptoms that are confined to or above the neck, then you're okay. So if you have a runny nose, if you have nasal congestion, if you have a sore throat, then you're probably going to be okay to train as long as you stay within that effort zone where you don't feel like you're overdoing it. And that takes some discipline. But if you have systemic symptoms, anything below the neck, if you have fever, if you have sore muscles, which we call myalgias, if your heart rate is high, if you're having gastrointestinal symptoms like nausea or vomiting or diarrhea, well, that's more concerning. And in those situations, then in that case, you know what? It's really not so safe to continue. And so at this point, we should probably turn to individual types of illnesses and talk about when it's safe to train through them. And if it is or if it isn't, how you should kind of return to your normal training afterwards. So which illnesses should we start with here?
Let's talk about, you know, the common one we see right now is sort of cold, flu. I know those are two separate categories, but, you know, that's what we're seeing a lot of still in mid-February.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think respiratory illnesses, of course, the most common thing we see. And you know, I was told my mom when I was growing up, you know, she, you know, put on a hat, you're going to catch cold. Make sure that you bundle up, you're going to catch cold, right? And the reality is that we don't catch a cold by going outside when it's cold. The reason that respiratory illnesses are so prevalent in cold weather climates is because we're spending more time indoors. We're spending more time indoors close to other people. And so viruses have a chance to jump from person to person. In the summer, when we're outdoors and, you know, the wind is blowing around us, we aren't in as close quarters. We aren't in confined environments, and actually respiratory illnesses go down. So it's called the common cold because it happens during cold weather, but it has nothing to do with your body temperature, nothing to do with whether or not you wear a hat. So, I love telling my mom how she, you know, persecuted me as a child. So this is just one other way. Made me spend all that time bundling up when I didn't have to. But you should bundle up anyways when it's really cold. But I digress. Okay. So colds, common colds caused by a variety of different illnesses. We've all become familiar with the term coronavirus. Well, the coronavirus, of course, the specific coronavirus that is referred to as COVID is a very specific one. But there are a host of other coronaviruses that cause common cold. There's also the respiratory syncytiovirus, which is RSV, which everybody also knows a lot about right now, but there are a variety of those. There are the adenovirus. There's just tons of them. And that's why we catch so many common colds, because there are so many of these viruses out there. Now, if you're like me and you've been working in medicine for as long as I have, you've caught so many of them during entering medical school and residency, when my kids come home with something, I'm actually a lot less likely to catch it because I've probably been exposed at some point. But
well, also, I don't really know if it matters if we have to name every single different virus. I think for many of us, it falls into the category of, is this a NyQuil illness or is this a non-NyQuil illness?
Yeah, that's fair. And the severity of the different illnesses has nothing to do with the virus, but rather how your immune response to that virus. Because all of the symptoms we get from a common cold is partly related to the virus itself and how it commandeers your respiratory cells. But most of it has to do with how your immune system then responds. Okay, so what happens is virus gets into the cells that line your nose and your throat, and they start causing all of these symptoms of runny nose and congestion and cough and sore throat and all of these things. Generally, it lasts about 5 to 7 days. And as I mentioned earlier, using the neck check is a very reasonable way to determine whether or not it's okay to train through a respiratory illness. So if you're not having fever, if you're not having myalgias, if you're not having any real systemic cough or anything like that, then yeah, you're probably okay to keep going. If, however, you're having any of those other things, it might mean that you have a more serious viral infection. The one that we think about most of the time is influenza. Now, Juliet, you just, you know, you sort of lumped these things together and said cold flu. And that is a very, very common thing that people say all the time. I see people coming all the time with a cold and they say, oh, I've got the flu. The flu generally refers to infection with the influenza virus. And influenza comes in two forms. It's influenza A and influenza B. Influenza A is the seasonal flu that changes every year. And that's the one that we have a vaccine for. The vaccine is of some limited efficacy, but it does help if you get it, because if you've been immunized and then get infected with the virus, we know that that immunization protects you against more severe illness and also protects you against spreading it to other people. So plug for the immunization. That being said, if you do get influenza, it is really, really not fun. It is a very serious, like, cold. It's going to knock you on your butt. Very serious myalgias, very, you know, high fevers. It's not fun. If you can avoid getting influenza, you really want to try to avoid it. And that's why I get vaccinated every year, because I don't want it and I'm exposed to it all the time. And if you have the opportunity to get vaccinated, I strongly encourage you to do so. If you choose not to, or if you are, anytime somebody has it, you want to try and keep yourself away, because it is a very contagious thing. That being said, if you have influenza, you're not going to feel like training through it, and you really have to take some time to recover. That one is going to take about 7 to 10 days to really run its course. And then once it's run its course, you're going to need a little time to get back to things. So with all respiratory illnesses, you know, we talked a little earlier about this fear of losing fitness, this fear of losing your ability to train. Well, we know through fairly abundant research that the duration of time that you've been training consistently leading up to illness has a big impact on whether or not you lose fitness when you take a break. And it's also the other thing that plays into that is your age. So unfortunately, you know, someone our age, we could take less time off before we start to lose fitness. But even for people our age, as long as you're training fairly consistently for months and months and months, getting sick, taking a week off, you will only need about 7 to 14 days to get back to exactly where you were before you were ill. So taking that time off should not be seen as a major, major impact on your overall fitness. And people need to be aware of that. It's important.
Yep. 100%. And I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, as Jeff said, if whether it's flu or a fever from another source, it's really hard to get up and train during a fever. I mean, it's a pretty cathartic process. Actually, I was telling my husband that, you know, you hear in the old days about when the fever breaks, right? Oh, the fever broke. Like, you're talking about someone who had scarlet fever or not scarlet fever, but I don't know, flu back in the 1918 or so. And like you could almost guess what your temperature is going to be when you go from 101 or 102 to something normal. You're like, oh, now the fever is gone. Like, you know, and then you're like, oh, I can move around again. But it's pretty obvious before then. Yeah, I'm not doing anything besides walking the dog around the block today. And even that is hard.
Yeah, and fever is cyclical with influenza. With a lot of illnesses, fever is cyclical. And just because your fever breaks, you shouldn't take that as – and I 100% agree. I mean, you know when your fever yeah. breaks. I mean, sometimes it's accompanied by a sweat, sometimes, but you feel it. It's amazing. That switch just flips. Yep. And you'll feel instantly so much better, but that's not – that should not be taken as, permission. Oh, I'm going to go train now because my fever broke. Because fever is cyclical. It doesn't mean the illness is gone. It just means that you're now into that period where your fever is going to be gone, but it's very likely coming back for another round. So don't go and just, you know, do something crazy like swimming, especially.
Where well, really that's exactly what happened. Yeah. Fever broke Wednesday night. I was fine. And then Sunday I went to the pool. Sunday night I had a fever again. It was like, I guess I should have called yeah. you, Jeff.
Yeah. And again, the swimming didn't cause the fever. It's just that the illness is cyclical right. like that. And I don't know. For me, when I'm sick, I do not want to swim. Right. I don't like the temperature changes and the water. Yeah, I just don't like yeah. it. Okay. Another illness that
yeah,
we
sure.
should
well,
discuss?
I think we've covered COVID. Well, we haven't really covered COVID in depth. I know that's a whole episode in and of itself. Do you want to just briefly touch on that a little further?
Well, just briefly. Yeah. Yeah. COVID remains a big problem. I know that we want to put it in the rearview mirror. We don't want to be thinking about it anymore. But the reality is that COVID continues to percolate in the population. It's going to be a seasonal illness. We're likely never going to get rid of it. Fortunately, it has mutated to be a lot less serious. Though I was talking to a friend of ours, Kelly, mm-hmm. who unfortunately has been struck down for the third time, and she is really suffering. She's not happy. So it's still for some people it can be really unpleasant. And when you get COVID, there is still the risk of its systemic involvement. So if you do test positive for COVID, you know, we used to think that there was a big impact on the heart, and we used to think that, oh, there's this major risk factor for cardiac death and all this stuff. We think that that's probably less serious now because the different mutations that have happened have made its predilection for affecting the heart significantly less. So the idea that you're going to suddenly, you know, increase your heart rate and die is not felt to be as much of a fear. That's not to say it's zero. There is still thought to be some potential risk because COVID does affect pretty much all the tissues in the body. So if you test positive for COVID, the advice remains to stop training completely until 7 days after the first test, or until at least 24 to 48 hours after all your symptoms have resolved, whichever one is longer. And for most people, that works out to be about 7 days. So you really do want to take it easy with COVID. And then once you have started training again after COVID, you really want to pay heed to your heart rate and to your overall perceived feelings of exertion. If your heart rate is shooting up with really minimal effort, that's a sign that you need to just stop. Stop training, give it another day or two, then come back and just watch your heart rate. And what you'll see is certainly what I found when I had COVID was I needed an extra week or so before I could really train at zone two with a zone two heart rate. And then I would start increasing the amount of effort I put in. COVID is one that, unfortunately, if you get it, you're probably going to need a longer kind of transition back into training. But some people get lucky. Some people don't have any issues. If you do have serious COVID, if you have COVID that is like, you know, if you have an underlying illness like asthma and you get COVID, you're probably going to want to speak to a physician about possibly getting further testing before returning to training. But that's going to be an individual decision. And again, the risk of heart involvement is significantly less now. The one thing I do want to mention is long COVID. We don't know how often this is happening, but it is still happening, and it is still happening to a fair number of people. And long COVID is simply defined as COVID that has symptoms that it last for like 2 weeks or longer. So the illness has gone away and you're still having symptoms of usually fatigue. But sometimes it can also be things like muddled thought or things like that. And if it lasts for 2 weeks, then that's considered long COVID. So that number can be quite high in terms of the number of patients who have long COVID, but by 12 weeks, the vast majority of people have resolved. So long COVID tends to affect a minority of people by 12 weeks, but unfortunately, there are still a fair number of people who are still affected. We are seeing that people who exercise regularly who get COVID tend to be less likely to get long COVID, but not impossible. And there are studies that are now starting to show that if you can exercise with symptoms of long COVID, you can actually make those symptoms better. Hmm. So exercise seems to be helpful both for preventing long COVID and for treating it. Hmm. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that that in the future will show more promise and turn out to be something that can help people with long COVID. But we know that people with the worst long COVID, they can't exercise. They're just so exhausted. Yeah. So real.
Yeah. Problem. So much we're going to continue to learn about that particular virus or infection. Okay. Speaking of infections, let's move on. I wonder if we can cover strep and sinus in the same fell swoop because they're both infections, right? Which means you usually get a course of antibiotics to address them.
All right. Well, let's talk about strep first. Strep is caused by a specific bacteria called group A strep. It is something that we usually see in childhood, but more and more we do see it in adults as well. It's something that's important to treat in childhood because untreated strep infections are known to lead to rheumatic fever. And rheumatic fever affects the heart and could lead to rheumatic heart disease. And with the introduction of penicillin as treatment for strep throat, we don't see rheumatic heart disease anymore in the Western world. It is still something that is encountered in less developed countries. So the treatment of strep throat, important for children. The question of whether or not it's important in adults remains kind of not so clear. Using antibiotics to treat strep throat in adults, we think might shorten the duration of illness a little bit, but it's not totally clear. It certainly doesn't do anything to prevent rheumatic fever because that doesn't seem to be as much of a concern in adults. That being said, if you have a really sore throat and you do test positive for strep, we still treat it. It's kind of still the standard of care. Again, whether or not it's actually going to make you better quicker, don't really know, but it is still the standard of care. What I will say is we have talked on this program before about the importance of the microbiome, and that is the bacteria that live in our guts and help us metabolize fuels and have been shown to be very important for exercise performance. And it turns out, you know, taking antibiotics, not so great, wipes out your microbiome, right? So if you can avoid taking antibiotics, you really want to try to do so. If you do have to take antibiotics for strep throat, make sure you take some probiotics. You want to take the antibiotics for strep as short a duration as possible. Some doctors are prescribing it for as long as 10 days. That should not be your optimal choice. We know that strep can be treated in as short as 5 days. So 5 days of antibiotics for strep is all you need. And then after that, get yourself on some probiotics, yogurt, kimchi, pickles, you know, all the things we've talked about. Go back and listen to our episode on the microbiome if you want more help. Now, sinusitis. Sinusitis is a big bugaboo for me because everybody thinks they've got a bacterial infection with sinusitis. And studies have definitively shown that if you take 100 people with sinusitis, 99 of them have a viral infection. And only one of them will truly need antibiotics. Sinusitis, I want to make this very clear, people. Sinusitis is a viral problem and does not respond to antibiotics. I don't care. I don't care what's coming out of your nose. I hear people come to me all the time. It's green coming out of my nose. I know. The reason it's green coming out of your nose is just because your immune system is doing the job of killing all the cells that are infected with virus. And when that happens, they become green. And when you blow your nose, it's disgusting. I know. It looks gross. It might even smell gross because those are dead cells in there. But you know what? You don't need antibiotics. What do you need? You need Afrin. You need something that's going to open up your nasal passages and relieve that pressure and let all that gunk come out. But please, if you feel like you have a sinusitis, which is just inflammation of the lining of the nose, usually from a viral infection, think long and hard before you go to get antibiotics. Because again, you're wiping out your microbiome because sinusitis has to be treated for 14 days of antibiotics. And that is no bueno. Number two. You don't need antibiotics, so don't ask for them. Number three, you don't need antibiotics, so please don't ask for them. I don't think I have anything else to say on sinusitis. It's a bugaboo for me because people have been conditioned. You know, it's like bronchitis. Right. There's this sort of like thing in the ether that bronchitis is somehow a bacterial infection. Bronchitis is a viral in fact, people cough when you get a cold. It is very well known that it irritates the small, you know, the bronchioles in our lungs, and it makes us cough. That's called bronchitis, but it's viral. And yet there are physicians out there who will prescribe antibiotics that are unnecessary, and it makes people have bigger problems, and that it wipes out their microbiome and causes other problems. So bronchitis, sinusitis, you don't need antibiotics. Treat them symptomatically and you'll be much better off.
Everybody
and you
got
can train
that?
Through it.
Yeah. You know, so funny, quick story. I lived as an expat in Amsterdam for 2.5 years. And, you know, they will not prescribe antibiotics unless you are on death's door. And all the expats, especially the Americans who go over and live over there, you know, the standing joke was you go in to your doctor and they send you home and say, tell you to take 3 days off and drink a lot of tea. And there's just no way that you could get antibiotics. And it was always a sort of like badge of victory if you finally got antibiotics by going to a Dutch doctor. Anyway, I think they probably have it right. But message heard, no antibiotics for sinusitis.
Yeah. We should probably just touch on one last one, which is not so much a winter illness, but more of a summer illness, and that's gastroenteritis. Mm. And I think it's important to talk about just because it has a real impact on our training. So gastroenteritis, often viral again, although this one is much more commonly, if we talk about the, you know, how often you get bacteria or parasites, gastroenteritis, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. You can get this from food poisoning, which can be toxin-based, or it can be bacteria. Like Shigella, Salmonella. But gastroenteritis, no matter how you get it, it's a serious issue for training, because what it does is it negatively impacts your microbiome and it negatively impacts your ability to absorb fluids. So if you have gastroenteritis, this is, again, going back to our neck check. It's symptoms that are below the neck. It's systemic. And so for that reason, you really should not be trying to train through it. You just are not going to be able to adequately hydrate. You won't be able to adequately take in the electrolytes that are needed to replenish what you're losing through sweat on top of what you're losing through diarrhea. And it can be dangerous to try and train through an episode of gastroenteritis. So really get those symptoms under control. Wait until the gastroenteritis is completely resolved. And then, even then, you need to remember that often you have become pretty dehydrated over the course of an episode of gastroenteritis, and you'll need a day or two to really get your hydration and electrolyte status back to normal before you go back to training in any kind of intensity.
And you know what? We don't want you in the pool anyway. Let's just be clear about that, because you never know what
you're going to turn into. Yeah. you raise a huge and important thing that I think we should close on. And that is, you know, the decision about whether or not to train when you're sick is a personal one, but you want to be sure that that personal decision doesn't impact anybody else. And many of the things we've talked about are really contagious. Yeah. So if you are going to train through a cold, if you are going to train through, not influenza, you shouldn't be doing that. But if you're going to train through a cold, if you're going to train through a mild gastro or something like that, please, please, please recognize that you are potentially contagious to others, and do so in your home. Do so on the trainer. Don't go to group activities. Don't be sharing your water bottle. Don't do all of the things that could potentially spread that illness to others. Have the courtesy to, you know, and also you're going to want to be at home anyways. You're going to want to be so that if you don't feel well, you're able to stop the workout and just go to bed instead. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just make sure that you do all the things that are meant to take care of you and also take care of the others that you train with.
100%.
Excellent.
Golden rule.
Well, this was a good and helpful conversation, I hope, for listeners. Juliet, I always enjoy them. I hope that you are completely recovered from your illness and back to your regular training.
Thank you.
And that anybody listening will take this advice and get themselves back to health as soon as possible as well. If you have a question for us to consider answering on the medical mailbag, I hope that you'll reach out and send it in. You can reach me by email at tri_doc@icloud.com. You can join the private Facebook page on that platform. Just answer the 3 easy questions. Once you find the private group, I will grant you admittance. You can join the conversation there and ask your questions, and we will gladly consider them for inclusion on the medical mailbag. Until the next episode, Juliet, lots of chicken soup, lots of fluids. Take care, and we'll talk to you then.
Thanks, Jeff. This was fun.
My guest on the program today is Christina M. Ramirez. She is a three-time Ironman athlete, a serial entrepreneur, and the best-selling author of the book Empowerment by Discomfort, bringing her empowerment curricula to audiences everywhere, from children to corporations. Her programs have been implemented across 40 states and with well over 11,000 individuals, from children to corporate executives. Christina's lived a really wide-ranging and active life that includes the co-founding with her friend of Thumbs Up International, an organization that pairs adaptive and able-bodied athletes to allow pairings to compete and complete endurance events. She also developed the Empower Fit curriculum for teaching the growth mindset through running games, and we're going to talk about all of that during the next half an hour or so. She's a graduate of Wellesley College and a seasoned veteran of both Wall Street and Silicon Valley. She is skilled at challenging limitations and finding possibilities. She's made it her personal mission to empower others to face their challenges with confidence. Christina is a widowed single mom of two teenage boys, and she lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, just down the road from me. And in her free time, you're likely to find her snowboarding with her sons, hiking with the dogs, or cleaning the cat litter. But today, I've got her to sit down just long enough and join me here on the TriDoc podcast. Christina, thank you so much for joining me today.
And thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Well, Christina, tell me how, because I know my listeners are going to be most interested in how it was you found yourself getting into triathlons.
So that's a funny story, because I was the girl in the back of the gym smoking pot all through high school. I was not your athlete at all. And I was actually an addict, and I've been sober for 21 years. But when I had my kids, which was already in sobriety, I wanted to be the cool, active mom. I wanted to do things with them. And I couldn't even run around the block without gasping for air. So I said, I'm going to run a 5K. And it felt like that was going to be an enormous feat for me. And when I finished that 5K, you would have thought I won an Olympic gold medal by how I felt. It was like, holy crap. Like, I ran a 5K? No way. And if I can do that, like, what else can I do? And it was that feeling that if I could bottle that up and sell it, was that feeling that kept me going. That became like my new high. And so that took me to 10Ks. It took me into the world of triathlon. And once I did my first sprint triathlon, I was hooked, because it gave me the variety of the sports, all the things that we love about triathlon. And that's how I got started.
And you mentioned addiction. There is no question, I think, that triathlon leverages very much from an addictive personality. I know myself, yes. So many others get into it, and we all often talk about triathlon being somewhat of an addiction. How long did it take you to go from that sprint to your first Ironman?
It took, I think, a year and a half, which it was fast. And I think I paid the price for all of that later. My body, it lasted all that time. And then once I was done, it just started slowly falling apart piece by piece. I do think I went too fast.
So this could be maybe a bit of a personal question, but I don't know if you're familiar with what goes on in the professional ranks of triathlon these days, but one of the very popular professionals is Lionel Sanders, who is a countryman of mine from Canada. And he is very, very open with his story of addiction and redemption through sport. Mm-hmm. He is incredibly successful at the Ironman and half Ironman distances, and pursues the sport with a ferocity and with a very single-minded determination that kind of shows you how he has that very addictive personality. And I, for one, have wanted to get him on this program for many years, partly because I'm a huge fan, but also because I've wanted to ask him as a physician if he worries that once he steps away from the sport, if that addictive side of his personality is going to manifest itself again in some potentially more destructive ways. I wonder, for you, as you transitioned from addiction, went into maybe triathlon as a substitute, and then came out of triathlon, did you ever find that addictive part of your personality rearing its head again? And if so, how did you satisfy it?
Well, I think that the addictive part of my personality just makes me focus on things, and I will do that always, whether it is triathlon or my business or parenting or whatever it is that I do. if I sign up for it, like I'm going to do it with gusto. And I think, so instead of it, I seeing it as a hindrance, as something's like, oh my gosh, I have to fill this void. I don't feel that at all. I feel like my life is full, but I use it to my advantage that whatever it is that I'm going to do, I'm going to do it obsessively, but I don't feel like, oh, it's this, I don't feel it as a negative. I feel it as a positive, like it's something that I can harness.
And the endorphin rush that you would get from physical activity, have you replaced that with something else?
I mean, I still do physical activity. I just don't race triathlons. So I race in snowboarding, which is pretty funny because I'm actually very slow, but I love it. So I love being on the mountains in the winter. And then in the summer, I do less, but I go hiking. I have other outlets for that, for sports. It's just not racing triathlons.
You find it somewhere else, of course. Mm-hmm. So tell me about Thumbs Up International. That is an that is an organization that I looked into a little bit before we had a chance to get together here, and I think it's fantastic. Tell me how that came to be and what your involvement was.
So it actually started when I was my first Ironman. It was Ironman Florida, and I thought I was such a badass for being there. So I was like on the beach. I was like, oh my God, I'm so ready for, look at everything that I have accomplished. Feeling really good about myself. And then next to me was this woman who was blind. And so she was tied to her guide and she had never swam in the ocean. And this is Ironman Florida. It's an ocean swim. And I was just floored. I was just like, oh my, like what bravery of this woman to be doing that and of the guide. And I kept seeing them across the course. And I don't know how to explain it. I just know that in that moment, I knew that I was there so that I could do this for somebody else because I never had an issue. I never had a flat. I never had a bike accident. Like I was always healthy. Like I got to Ironman Florida on this little cloud that just took me from point A to point B. So I got back to Miami and I was like, all right, well, who can I do a triathlon with? And at that time, there weren't that many people that did that. And I got connected to my friend, Carrie Grusin, who has an incredible story. And she's a daredevil. Like she's done shows like scuba dive with sharks. She was a competitive sailor and she's quadriplegic. So I asked her if she wanted to do a triathlon with me and she said yes. And I told her that I have no idea what we're doing. She's like, doesn't matter. We'll figure it out. And we did. And we just figured it out and we did the South Beach Triathlon. And oh my God, so many people came out of the woodwork to help us because we needed help, but also because there were so many people that wanted to help. And I realized there's a need here. Like there's so much desire to do this. Like, why is it always me? Why is it all? Cause we did a bunch of other races. I'm like, I'm the lucky one that gets to do this, but all these other people that want to help can't. So we founded Thumbs Up, which her signature move is a thumbs up, as a way for other people to be able to participate and to other adaptive athletes to participate. And now you'd be hard pressed to find a race in Miami that does not have at least one pair of adaptive athletes. And also kids pushing kids. Like it's beautiful. And I'm no longer involved. I've been away for a time, but they really do amazing, fantastic, inspiring work.
And are they just in the Florida area or have they spread out? Because the name international suggests they might be somewhere else as well.
I think that's the intention. I don't think they have gotten there yet. But Carrie, like I've lived overseas most of my life. Carrie has traveled all over the world as well. So I think it's something that she really would like to do.
That's terrific. And did you get to do any races longer than short distance or did you do an Ironman together or was it mostly the shorter distances?
No. So it's a great story of letting go, right? Because I started this and that race was really hard for me. Remember, I was the girl in the back of the gym smoking pot. Like I was not your standard athlete. And she is super competitive. She doesn't just want to finish. Like she wants to win. And I'm not that person. Like I'm a back of the pack athlete. So she, I paired her up and she met all these other amazing athletes. She's actually has two world records for an ultra Ironman, I think it's called, and for Ironman as well. I can't remember specifically what her world records are, but with an athlete, her name is Karen, who is way more qualified than I am to do those things. I can't. That's not me. But letting her go and seeing that she wanted to do these things that I couldn't take her there was a real lesson in humility and in letting go for me.
That's fantastic. Well, tell me about Empower Fit, because clearly that's something where you didn't let go, but you actually picked up the reins and did it. So tell me what Empower Fit is all about.
Sure. So after I finished in Lake Placid, I went back home and I had quit my job as a teacher, and I needed $600 to pay for my kids' music lessons. And it drove me bananas that here I was, like, having done 3 Ironmans, and my kids were just not into running. Just not. They're music kids, and they still are. They're teens and they go to art school. So I thought that if I got their friends running, that maybe they would run too. So I went to the principal and I said, hey, can I do a little run club after school and I'll donate a percentage of my profits back to the PTO? She said, great. I said, great. And I had about 20 kids and I took them to do a 5K. And guess what happened at that 5K? The same thing. Like these are like first and second graders, like running. They cried the entire race. But the last, like, they complained. They're just like, I hate this. But those last 50 yards or 30 yards, and they crossed the finish line, and they felt the same thing that I had felt in my first 5K, that, oh my God, I just did this. And so I realized I was onto something, and I believe that confidence comes from doing difficult things. So I created a curriculum to teach, to have that feeling, but inside a class without it having to be a race. So I developed these games that were challenging and that were difficult, but the kids were supported so that they could ultimately be successful. And it took about 3 years to get it right. Like, sometimes I thought I was a genius, and then I had like 6 kids crying, and I was like, well, maybe not so much of a genius after all. But now we got the curriculum, and it's called Empower Fit, and we've coached, like you mentioned, like well over 11,000 kids with that curriculum, empowering them.
So what does the curriculum involve? I mean, obviously it's more than just learning how to run a 5K. What are you're obviously doing something at the same time as you're training them up. So what is it that you're doing?
Sure. So it's all game-based, right? And we have some empowerment principles and we match them to a running skill. So I'll give you an example about positive attitude. So when you're running, at least when I was running and when kids run, you're running and kids always start too fast and then they always get too tired. So they're like, oh my God, this is so hard. I can't breathe. And I can't breathe because I suck at running and because I'm too fat, because I'm too this, because I'm Miss Johnson. She yelled at me in math class and I suck at math too. And before you know it, they're walking and they hate running and they never want to do it again. So we teach them to expect those negative thoughts and then to turn them around into something that's more positive that will encourage them to keep running. So we have this game of tag where we have positive thoughts and negative thoughts, and the negative thoughts have to tag the positive thoughts, but they can't run away. They've got to take them and then they've got to pass it on to somebody else. So it's a really kinetic way of teaching them how to change their thought process while they're running. So we do that one class, and then another class, the next class, we're like, okay, what's the running posture? So you've got to stand tall, shoulders back, lead with your heart and smile. And you can't have that posture and think, I'm too fat. So we start tying the mental, the growth mindset part of it to the physical aspect of running. And we have 8 weeks of that. And we cover things from how to speak to yourself, competition, how you're not competing against the other person, because kids don't like kids now. They don't like to compete. They're afraid of competing because they're afraid of losing. And so we try to say, you're not competing against the other person. You're competing against who you were yesterday. And we turn everything into a race, and they always win and they always lose. They lose a lot. And that's the point. So that's how we kind of intertwine those things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense. And do you tackle the fixed mindset at all? Do you even broach it as a subject of something? Because I'm sure within your groups, you're probably coming across kids who have fixed mindsets, and you probably want to have the conversation of, look, this is where you're at. This is where we'd like you to be. Do you tackle it, or do you just only expose them to growth mindset principles and hope they're going to get there on their own?
Well, it kind of depends because we work from two-year-olds all the way up. So you're not going to talk to a five-year-old or a kindergartner about this. But the older kids, like middle schoolers, we talk about that a lot and how, but ultimately how they are in control of how they choose to see themselves in the world. So it's not so much saying it's like, well, right now you're here and we want to get you here and this is the plan. It's just saying you have an option. This is not the only way that you can think about things. Here I'm exposing you to a different way of thinking, but nobody can control that. Only you can decide how you're going to think about this. And so we give them the opportunity of trying it out, you know, of playing this game and playing full out and again, losing and winning and trying to reframe that loss as learning.
Did you develop this on your own or did you have input from other people to help you? Because it's really fascinating.
Thank you. No, it was on my own because I would just do it in the classes. I'm a teacher. I love this stuff. I love making up games. So some coaches, I had like young coaches, like basketball players or whatever, and they would come up with, well, we could try this way or we could do that way. But there wasn't like, this is a team of experts that is coming to blah, blah, blah. It wasn't like that at all.
And the empowerment curricula, is that basically just learning the skills or the strategies that are taught in this?
Yeah. So we have eight different themes that we teach. And again, everything from the way you think to competition to community, integrity. And a lot of our kids repeat, like over, it's an unofficial number, but it is like over 50% of our children do it at least twice. So it's just, again, like it's embedding this way of thinking into who they are. And by doing it through running, which is not necessarily easy, right? It's something that demands something of you. I think that those lessons are embedded in a much more significant way than you learning from a teacher in a classroom.
And when you go speak to audiences, you obviously can't be doing some of these games or these exercises. Mm-hmm. So how do you speak to them? I mean, what are you telling them? What are you talking to them about that conveys some of these same kind of life lessons?
So what I do is that I train people to do the curriculum in their communities. And we have an entire program for that. So when they join us, we teach them A, how to start a business, because this is a business, B, the curriculum, and then how to teach that curriculum to their kids. And then we have an entire success strategy coaching and mindset coaching for the person that is teaching, because they cannot teach what they don't have. So they can't be telling the kids like, well, you need to think this way. And inside they think it's like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And oh my God, like it doesn't work that way. So we need to work with them and make sure that they have adopted their own growth mindset, that it's okay for them to make their own mistakes. And then they're going to go and teach it to the kids.
Yeah, you can't teach a growth mindset if you yourself have a fixed mindset, right?
Exactly.
that's where you break down. And it's so interesting because there are so many parallels. I know within triathlon, I see so many coaches who themselves clearly have a fixed mindset and they're trying to imbue their athletes with a growth mindset. And I'm like, yeah, it's probably not going to work so well. In your experience, when you encounter people who have fixed mindsets, and this is something we've talked about on this program with other guests, I've had mindset coaches come on, and it seems like you get to a certain point in your life where if you have a fixed mindset, and I've alluded to my own journey where I felt like I was deep in the throes of adulthood, very much with a fixed mindset. And it took a very long time for me to gradually transition to a growth mindset. And it wasn't something I consciously did. It just kind of happened. I wasn't even aware of the terms. But it was only once I learned of the terms that I could look back and sort of see, oh, yeah, I had a fixed mindset for the longest time. And it was only once I got to a growth mindset that I was able to really see my own abilities and my own successes in sport change. When you encounter people who have fixed mindsets, what kind of tools do you give them, and have you had success in getting people to transition from fixed to growth?
100%. Because the same thing that happened to you happened to me. Like I read the book, like my growth mindset is coined by this professor, Carol Dweck from Stanford. And she wrote the book called Mindset. And it's a really boring read, but I'm a nerd and I loved it. And I was reading it and I was like, oh my God, if you saw in the dictionary a definition of fixed mindset, my picture would be next to it. Like, it, that was me. And so, like you, it was once I learned that, oh, my, that's what I'm doing. I don't have to think this way. Everything changed for me. So I do a lot of like corporate trainings in companies and things like that, where I expose people to these concepts so that they can then decide for themselves, well, I don't want to live like this anymore, right? It's like you can't improve upon what you don't measure. So there's like a little quiz that you can take that's in the book so that you could see where you are. And then I have tools to teach adults, okay, well, you're in control. Like, you get to choose how you want to face the challenges in your life. And you can do as you were doing and have your fixed mindset, and that's going to have one result. But you might, like, if you try something different and you try to think this way, you might just have a different result. But ultimately, the power, like, I want to empower somebody to make that decision and to make those choices and to make that change for themselves. Otherwise, it's not going to work and it's not going to be lasting.
Can you give us an example, or is that a trade secret
of
a kind of tool that you would give somebody to help them? Because I struggle with this. I have athletes who are very clearly fixed mindset. They tell me, this is what I can accomplish. And I'm like, well, no, we're working together. I'm giving you a process. And the whole idea is to get you out of that idea. So what kinds of tools do you use to help people?
Sure. So it's going to take me like 3 minutes to get through the tool. Is that okay? All right.
Cool. Absolutely. Okay. Take all the time you need.
So I wrote it in a book. It's called Empowered by Discomfort, but I call it the power wheel. And I tell people, it's like, so it starts with your thoughts. And when I work with kids, I tell them, as a parent, I can control what you eat, what school you go to, you know, what you do after school, but I cannot control what goes on within your ears. So that's power. And that's a power that a lot of us don't take for ourselves. We give it to other people. So it starts with your thoughts, and then it's your words. Your words are just your thoughts expressed. So nobody can make you mouth, I suck at running, or I cannot run more than this. Nobody can say that for you but yourself. And that's power. And the story, the thoughts and the words that you use more often are your stories that you believe are true, become your beliefs. So if you tell yourself enough times, I can't run more than a 10-minute mile, that's a belief, and that's going to be your truth. And that belief is a gatekeeper. It's going to either empower you to take action, or it's going to hold you back from taking action. Both are viable options, because inaction is another form of a decision and of action. And that action is going to have a result, and that result is going to reinforce the thought. But it starts with the thought. So I can spin this wheel in a positive direction, right? And I can say, well, I'm getting better at running. And my belief is that maybe it's really hard for me, because it is, but I'm getting better. And I have a coach, and I have the skills that I can possibly do better than what I'm doing now. If I have that belief, I'm going to go to the track, and I might push myself a little bit more on that 400 by 400 or whatever exercise you're going to do, right? Because I have that belief that there is the possibility to change. And then that's going to give me different results, which is going to reinforce the thought is, okay, running is difficult, but I'm getting better. But ultimately, or I can have is, no, I suck at running. My body wasn't made to run, and I'm never going to run more than, I don't know, I keep using a 10-minute mile. And if that's my belief, and there's nothing that you or I can do to change that, because it's the person's thoughts that they have determined. And if they're not open to thinking a different way, there's nothing that we can do about it, right? But we can show them that if they just change their thought and just give it a try for one session, like just in this session, try to think a different thought, and the wheel is going to spin in a different direction.
So begin with thoughts, translate that to words. Those words become beliefs. One of the things that I struggle with a lot, and I've asked a lot of people like in positions like yourself, I came from a position where I had this belief that I was only so good because it was borne out by my circumstances. And eventually, when I had more time to be able to train and put into my triathlon lifestyle, I started to see better success. And then my success started to make me believe that I would be able to do better. And then I did. And it sort of fed on itself. Mm-hmm. And so I've come to coaches like yourself and people like yourself, and I ask this question all the time. What has to happen first? Because a lot of people can go in and say, I believe I can run a 6-minute mile, but that might not be anywhere close to reality. Mm-hmm. So what comes first? Is there, does the belief begin by having a success, or because you can, like, you can have success without believing it, and all of a sudden go, wow, I did so well. Now I'm going to believe going forward that I can do that well. Or do you have to believe that you can achieve things and then maybe not quite achieve what you thought you could, but you still have this belief going forward and you're going to do great things anyways? Like, which, you know what I'm saying? Like, I struggle with this a lot in how to teach my own kids. How much belief do you want to have?
Yeah. So my answer to that is it's both and. I don't think it has to be an either or. So, and it's actually one of the lessons that we do in run clubs. So we tell the kids, okay, you have 2 minutes. How many laps do you think you're going to be able to run in 2 minutes? And then you have the kid that says, I'm going to run 1,000,000 laps in 2 minutes. And then you have the kid that says, I'm going to run 2. And you have everybody in between. And their guesses are based on, like, on nothing, because they've never done it. So then they run the laps, and the kid that said that they were going to run 1,000,000 miles maybe ran 10, and he's like, okay, so maybe it's not going to be 1,000,000 miles. And the kid that ran 2, that said 2, probably ran only 2, right? So you have to dance a little bit between, like, experience and thoughts. And it's not like thinking that, well, I have to have this thought so that I can do this thing, is a little bit of that fixed mindset, because it doesn't allow you to change. Whereas every time that we go out there, for every practice that we have, for every experience that we have, that goes informing our beliefs, and it goes informing who we are. And from that space, we can make better decisions. But if we're at least open to knowing that we can change from a 6 mile that's not realistic to a 10, or from a 10 to a 6, being able to play with the thoughts and the actions and kind of go molding that to get to where you want to be. Does that answer your question?
It really does. I really like that. It's like having this belief, but also allowing for that belief to be molded by reality. And yeah. I think that really does answer the question. Well, Christina, I can't thank you enough for a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation. This was really terrific. Christina is herself a 3-time Ironman athlete, reformed somewhat, but still staying active and doing what she can. She's the developer of the Empower Fit curriculum that we've been talking about quite a bit, and she's the best-selling author of the Empowered by Discomfort book that talks about her curriculum and about the growth mindset that she tries to give to kids all across the country. Christina, thank you so much for being here on the TriDoc podcast today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for another episode. The TriDoc podcast is produced and edited by me, Jeff Sankoff, along with my interns.
I'm Agent Johnson. This is Special Agent Johnson.
Oh, how you doing?
No relation.
I'm Jeff Sankoff, the TriDoc. I'm in charge here.
Not anymore.
Those interns are Ian Johnson and Ben Johnson. You can find the show notes for everything discussed on the show today, as well as archives of previous episodes, at TriDocPodcast.com. Do you have questions about any of the issues discussed on this episode, or do you have a question that you'd like for me to consider answering on a future episode? Send me an email at TRI_DOC@iCloud.com, or join the private TriDoc Podcast Facebook group on Facebook, and you can submit your questions there. If you're interested in coaching services, please visit TriDocCoaching.com or LifeSportCoaching.com, where you can find a lot of information about me and the services that I provide. You can also follow me on the TriDoc Podcast Facebook page, TriDoc Coaching on Instagram, and the TriDoc Coaching YouTube channel. If you enjoyed this podcast, I hope that you'll consider leaving me a rating and a review, as well as subscribe to the show wherever you download it. And of course, there's always the option of becoming a supporter of the podcast at patreon.com/TriDocPodcast. The music heard at the beginning and the end of the show is Radio by Empty Hours and is used with permission. This song and many others like it can be found at ReverbNation.com, where I hope that you'll visit and give small independent bands a chance. The Dry Dock Podcast will be back again soon with another medical question for me to answer and another interview with someone in the world of multisport. Until then, remember 1121 and train hard, train healthy.